there's always room for new stuff. There's always room for a new wrinkle and a new approach into the outdoors. It's a great model, but it's not a perfect model. And I think what we need to accept as conservationists is that there's room for improvement in this model. It really exposes the animal rights organizations for the frauds that they are and what little they actually do for any wildlife or animals. If you don't have that, the lions are going to be gone. They're going to be relegated to the parks, and that'll be the end of it. There will not be lions outside of the parks. They get it. They understand there's got to be something big and different and bold. And we have to do it soon because, frankly, I think we're on the clock. This is Chris Dorsey of Sporting Classics Television, and you're listening to the Wild Initiative Podcast.
Put down your latte and pull on your boots.
Our culture needs people that are leaders and not people that are waiting for somebody else to show them how to do it.
Those fields of tofu, that was formerly habitat for wildlife. You're killing off wildlife by being a vegetarian just as much as a hunter when he kills a deer.
I'm like, well, you see that bush right there? There's your bathroom.
Yeah. My dad wears a Levi jacket. He sits in front of a sagebrush and he tells me the best camo is hold still.
Not to Donnie Vincent this, but be relentless in everything you do. Don't crap out. Go back to the truck with excuses or whatever.
Okay, assume I get a deer. How do I cut it up to fit into a Honda Civic?
Just get outside. Just get outside and go. Because once you do, it's all gravy from there.
Hey, this is Zach Griffith.
This is Hannah Barron.
This is Jason Phelps of Phelps Game Calls.
Hey, guys. This is Cody Rich from the Rich Outdoors Podcast.
What's up, guys? This is Chad Mendez.
You're listening to The Wild Initiative.
Hey, y'all. Welcome to another episode of The Wild Initiative Podcast, brought to you as part of the Waypoint Outdoor Collective.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal. Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
All right, y'all. So getting on to today's episode, excited to have Chris Dorsey on with me. Chris is, I mean, as far as all around hunters, Chris, you have done a little bit of everything, or a lot of everything, I should say. You're one of the most traveled hunters, if not the most traveled hunter, I would say, in the world. So I really appreciate you hopping on. Looking forward to this conversation.
Really excited to be on, actually. It'll be a lot of fun.
So one of the things I just love to start with is kind of an introduction about yourself, you know, who you are, what you do, and really who introduced you to the outdoors and hunting? How'd you get into all this?
You know, it's funny. I grew up in southern Wisconsin on a farm, and my father was not really much of a hunter. He did a little bit of hunting, a little bit of fishing, but it was really an older brother who got me into it. And he got into it because he had a friend whose father sort of took him hunting for the first time. And that was kind of the baptism. And I really started mostly as a herd dog and chasing rabbits for him. And I was a little hard mouth on the retrieve, but otherwise I kept getting called up to get out there and flush critters for him. And I just loved it, you know, just getting outdoors and being a part of what the older boys. I'm the youngest of nine kids. I've got five older brothers and pretty good age gap. You might say I was an afterthought or an accident, but it was a happy accident, I like to think. And so it was always a family affair for us getting outdoors. And so it was really, really just a great time to be with the older brothers and get out there. And then finally I got my own bird dogs and started training them at a pretty young age. So I've been doing this a long time. You know, it's funny. I feel like I've lived kind of an accelerated outdoor existence because I started so young because I had older brothers who got active in the outdoors and got me involved at a very young age. I think mostly because we couldn't afford our own bird dogs. I was it. But anyway, it was it's something I've been doing. It's really for me is who I am, not just what I do. And started in the magazine business out of college with the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point. You know, I was going to be a game warden. I was going to be a crick dick. I wanted to be the guy that was always out in the field, you know, arresting the bad guys that were poaching and all that kind of stuff. And then I quickly realized if you're doing that, you're missing the hunting seasons. And what's the point at that point? So sort of scratched my head and started writing. I edited the student newspaper and sold a piece to Glenn Sapier. And I think I was a sophomore in college at Field & Stream, and started writing columns for the Wisconsin newspapers. Did a column actually when I was a junior, I think, at Stevens Point for the Madison newspaper, which is the second largest newspaper, Wisconsin State Journal, then the Milwaukee Journal as well. And anyway, so that led into a lot of freelance writing, which got me into kind of the magazine business. And David Morris, the legendary whitetail guru and Bucks of Tecumseh star and all-around great guy, hired me out of college, actually, to run some magazines out of Atlanta called Game and Fish Magazines. I think they, at the time, had about 32, 33 state magazines. And so they hired me to edit these upper Midwest magazines, and that was kind of the baptism. Transferred over to Peterson's Hunting Magazine, where I'd actually interned in college for Craig Boddington and Todd Smith, who later went on to be the editor of Outdoor Life, and sort of did my stint there. And that's really, I would say, where I got this kind of wanderlust of this giant world of hunting and fishing, and that combined with, binge watching every American episode with Kurt Gowdy over the years growing up. There's just no way I was going to settle for honest work. I had to get into something like this. So anyway, that led to finding, our way into the outdoor television business. Really about 20 years ago now, we created a company called Orion Entertainment, and founded that when I was in LA. I was actually running Sports Afield magazine at the time for Bob Peterson, who had purchased that magazine from Hearst Magazines, which had Esquire and all sorts of other titles. And Terry McDonald, who went on to edit Sports Illustrated magazine, one of the legendary guys, worked for Jan Wenner at Rolling Stone and others, was my previous editor. He was the predecessor at Sports Afield. So took that over and then realized, look, there's a TV component here we could create, and created a television show around Sports Afield magazine. And quickly realized that all the advertising gravitated towards the television show, and they were iffy on the magazine at the time, but loved the television show. And so I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer here, but I figured, there seems to be something going on here. I think there's a trend here. Maybe we could create these branded entertainment television shows for the outdoor world. And at the time, we were working with TNN, OLN. TNN, of course, became Spike TV, which then became Paramount, which is what it is right now. So it's evolved over the years. And so anyway, it's been a hell of a run. I think we've created now 56 or 57 outdoor television series alone.
Wow.
And 50 plus series for mainstream cable from Discovery, History, National Geographic. We've got a new ABC project, our first broadcast network project coming. Got an IMAX film in production right now. And so I'm writing books on the side, hosting this Sporting Classics television series, which has become my guilty pleasure and my side hustle, I guess. But anyway, it's been a lot of fun. It's been a good run, and anything to keep me outdoors and active in the outdoors is something I enjoy, and I love it all. We have a lot of specialists, I think, in this world, and just whitetail deer guys that are better whitetail deer hunters than I am, better trout fishermen than I am, better bird hunters than I am, maybe. But I don't know of a lot of folks, frankly, who have done the breadth and scope of the sporting life. And I don't say that braggadociously. I just say that's always been my passion. Every season has its own activity, and I love to sort of immerse myself in all those. And I'm a work in progress, like a lot of sportsmen, just trying to get better at what I do and enjoy it more and share it more. And that's where the gig gets fun for me.
You mentioned kind of starting these outdoor television shows. And was there really anything like that to speak of at the time when you were first kicking a lot of this off?
Yeah, good question. It was pretty early in the game for sure. And I don't think anybody had really looked at it from a standpoint of there's a market need here. Clearly the brands want to electrify. Clearly they want to connect in ways that are different than traditional print. And look, as a recovering magazine editor, I've always loved ink and paper and fully control. And I think it still has a great place, particularly in these niche outdoor markets, I think Print's doing just fine. Thank you very much. But it was really kind of fun to look at it and go, Benelli and Beretta were really quick to jump into this television space and say, look, you know, we can give our brand personality. We can showcase the features and benefits of a firearm, of our product lines, really better in video than we can any other way. And it, when it comes to a medium moving somebody to the point of purchase, pretty damn tough to beat video, you know, whether it's online, whether it's in television, you know, streaming now, all those kinds of things. I mean, video really is the universal donor of content, and I would contend still is and probably always will be. So as a video content creator, we're fairly agnostic. We, you know, do we really care if it's on television or if it's streaming or if it's in a podcast or if it's, no, we really don't. It's wherever somebody wants to get their content, their information, their fix of entertainment through any source, we want to be there. We want to meet them where they live in media. And so that's kind of what we've done. There were other television producers out there, but most of them were sort of doing their show, right? It was Jim Shockey doing a show and doing it very well, very successfully, and building his own model. But what we said was, we think we could transport this to a lot of different brands, bring a lot of different television personalities into it, and sort of grow the entire category into something meaningful. And I think we did. I think we've had a lot of success with it over the years, and it's evolving. You know, as you know, you're living proof of how it's evolving. Leaving Los Angeles and jumping into the wilds of Montana and going all in, I think, is fantastic. And it's fun and funny. When I lived in Los Angeles editing Sports Appeal magazine and also a hunting magazine staff, both based in Los Angeles, which was interesting in and of itself. but we would find people all the time that we would baptize into the shooting sports, take them out fishing, take them over to Catalina and catch Mako sharks on a fly and watch them just, you know, sell everything they own so they could buy up or take them shooting and hunting and they would buy guns. A dear friend of mine, a Jewish kid from the Valley, who we stayed in touch over the years. He and his wife are good friends of ours. And he had never been exposed to firearms, had never gone hunting, and we got him involved, a very athletic guy. And so his hand-eye coordination was good. He had success shooting, and now he loves it. You know, he's just all about it. So it's fun to see people who come to it a little bit later in life, because I contend that they fall for it a little harder sometimes than folks who grew up with it. So anyway, that's my story. I'm sticking to it.
So have you seen in the years that you've been kind of developing this outdoor media and especially on the video side of things, television and streaming video, have you seen a shift or a change in the type of storytelling, the type of content, how it's being presented, what's going out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody has their own take on the space and the lifestyle and what they get out of it, what speaks to them, and consequently, that's what you want to share, right? You want to share what is meaningful, and sure, it's always nice to shoot a big animal if you're hunting. It's always great to catch big fish and lots of them, but I think there's a great deal of diversity out there now. And I think Ranella has done a great job with the meat eater concept. And I was tracking him a little bit when he was at Travel Channel. I remember meeting with the Travel Channel guys because we were pitching some different shows over there. And I said, you know, I really like forget even the name of that show, what it was called. But that was way before Meat Eater, right? He was doing sort of a travel show that involved a little bit of hunting and fishing and a little bit of food. And I just thought it was clever and interesting and different. And I remember saying that to the Travel Channel guys, and they're like, yeah, the show's not doing all that great. I'm like, well, that's too bad. I think it's a great show. I hope it continues, whatever. But then he's evolved that into something that really is focused largely on the public lands and sort of the democracy of hunting, if you will. And I think he's ignited the locavore movement into something bigger and different than I think what traditional outdoor TV was, And I think that says to me that there's always room for new stuff. There's always kind of room for a new wrinkle and a new approach into the outdoors, and just let your own focus group of one be the guide to create something fresh and different. And I think, you know, for me, it now has evolved into family. I mean, I've got two boys who are 15 years old who, you know, the force is strong in those kids when it comes to the outdoors. You know, they're much like I was at that age, although they have a hell of a lot more opportunities than I ever had at that age. But they love it. And they're twins, but they're completely different in their love of the outdoors. One loves to big game hunt and is a terrific rifle shot. One's a fly fishing absolute nut, tying his own flies. He's good at it. He can double haul. So they're growing their competency, but they're also growing as advocates, and they're also growing as people who understand in this category, you have a great deal of responsibility, I think, to give back to conservation, to be a voice for conservation. And I think that's one of the really great things about hunters and anglers in America, unlike anywhere in the world, and having traveled a good bit of this planet, you know, doing hunting and fishing activities, you just don't see what you see in America when it comes to private conservation organizations giving back, you know, the Pittman-Robertson Fund, the self-imposed excise tax that we hunters said we need to tax ourselves to raise money and really save wildlife in North America, not just game species, but the habitat that benefits all species, and including endangered neotropicals and non-target species. So I think we have a great story to tell, and I'm proud to be a part of that community that has done that. And I think it's always a work in progress. I think we always have to get better. People talk about the North American model of wildlife management, wildlife conservation. I call it the American model. I love our Canadian friends, but let's face it, you know, the genesis came from the United States. The money came from the United States. The vision to create this came from the United States. So I don't want to get too proprietary about it. And I love Shane Mahoney, who I think is the one in Canada who coined it. And John Muir lives. If you've ever seen Shane Mahoney, he's a spitting with John Muir. And he's a fantastic guy. And he's a great speaker and writer. Yep. So it's just a gentle gig every once in a while when we debate the American versus North American model. But it's a great model, but it's not a perfect model. And I think what we need to accept as conservationists, as leaders of the conservation community, is that there is room for improvement in this model. And I think we're looking at that all the time. When Pittman-Robertson was created, you know, we didn't have a fully fledged Ducks Unlimited. We didn't have, you know, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. We didn't have Quail Forever and Pheasants Forever and NWTF and Mule Deer and Max McGraw Wildlife. We didn't have a lot of those organizations, those private conservation organizations in place. So we said the only way we can do this is to tax ourselves, send it to the federal government, let them ship it back to the states. Well, I don't think you have to be a governmental skeptic and a to think that may not be the most efficient way to spend money. So I think there's going to be lots of discussions about how we go forward relative to where does this money go? Can the private conservation organizations qualify for some of the Pittman-Robertson money directly, not, you know, funneled through the federal government, you know, where you take X percentage of management fees off the top of that, ship it to the states where they've got their own overhead, and suddenly you lose a great deal of the efficiency of the money that sportsmen have spent. And it's sportsmen's money at the end of the day. It isn't the government's money. So I think there's going to be a lot of discussion about that. And you're seeing a lot of people now talking about accountability at the state level, at the federal level, with all this money flowing in, you know, are we getting results? You know, and again, I go back to the North American model, and it's a fantastic model, but let's improve it. Let's keep making it better. And that's something I sit on the board of the Congressional Sportsmen's Foundation. We've had lots of debates about that as well, lots of discussions. And that's really an industry board. That's a lot of the manufacturers in the industry, the big manufacturers sit on that board. So it's something we're all looking at, trying to get better and trying to get better results on the ground.
it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So with the amount you've traveled in, you know, I feel like you have a very unique insight on this. You know, you're very well versed in what we have here in the United States. And, you know, I guess we'll include Canada with that. You know, those guys up north, you know, you're very well versed in that, but then you've seen how so many other countries do that. And, you know, there's some that have started adopting similar methods or at least using hunting to create value for that wildlife. You know, you look at places like South Africa, mm-hmm. where they're one of the few places that also has the closest model to what we have going on as well. And you look at a lot of these other places in Africa where the areas that allow hunting are some of the only areas that actually have wildlife left in them. Just from your perspective, what have you seen in some of these other countries, and maybe what works, what doesn't work when it comes to hunting?
Well, it's a great question, because it really gets to the core of how does hunting and conservation, what is the role of hunting and conservation in these other nations? And what's sustainable, what works, what doesn't work. And one thing I think Safari Club International has done a really great job of is emphasizing to African nations, to the UN, to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, to international bodies that oversee, you know, CITES and things like that, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. They've really done a great job, you know, showcasing the value of hunting to conservation, to the sustainability of conservation in many countries around the world, and particularly in Africa. And look, at the end of the day, the axiom that holds true the world over is wildlife that pays stays. And if wildlife doesn't have an economic value, it won't be around. And for instance, I had some debates with folks talking about the Cecil the Lion issue, which was a big anti-animal rights, big social media blow up talking about, you know, this lion that was shot in Zimbabwe, I believe, and by a dentist in Minnesota. And look, at the end of the day, here's the story of lions in Africa. If there isn't value for the lion through hunting, what happens is they get poached, they get snared, they get poisoned, because they bring no value to the locals. So at the end of the day, conservation only works if it works for the local indigenous population. And all they see when they see a lion is dead livestock. They see family members that have been attacked or killed by those lions. There is no value to the locals that live with the lions in seeing a lion. They would just assume every lion be destroyed. And so if you don't give them a reason through economic incentive, like, you know, there's jobs, there's revenue coming back to these communities, there's employment because of hunting for these lions. And again, these are very, very limited, very controlled, managed hunts. This is not indiscriminate kind of hunting. If you don't have that, the lions are going to be gone. They're going to be relegated to the parks, and that'll be the end of it. There will not be lions outside of the parks. And it's just like the elephant situation in Kenya. When Dr. Richard Leakey ended famously the elephant hunting in Kenya, I think it was back in the 70s, he famously gathered all the ivory and burned it and invited all the international media, and they televised it. They took pictures. It was in the, you know, the International Herald, the London Times, it was all over the New York Times, et cetera. And he just heralded that as the end of elephant poaching, and it was going to be the savior of elephants going forward. Well, of course, we know what happened, right? Mm-hmm. And we need to tell that story. What happened was, once you took the hunters and the professional hunters off the land, there was no anti-poaching teams. There was no protection for those elephants. The poachers moved in mass, and they slaughtered the elephants. And so Kenya is now left with a tiny fraction of the elephants that they once had when they had legal hunting. And so the illicit trade in ivory is what it is. And it's driven traditionally by the Southeast Asian syndicates from Taiwan to China to Singapore, et cetera, where they're still trading in ivory. And it's created a really sad story for much of Africa, where they've outlawed hunting. And I think, you know, what you saw in Botswana, which Safari Club was very, very instrumental in getting Botswana to reconsider. But Botswana had caved to the pressure of banning all elephant hunting. And quickly, again, the poachers moved in like they always do. I mean, this is a common story. You know, take away hunting, take away the incentive to keep those elephants around, and guess what? They won't be around. And here's what's going to happen. Poachers move in, they wipe them out, ship them off to China. And President Assisi, I think is his name, in Botswana should be really applauded, because he was smart enough to step back and go, this is bad. The local economies are suffering. The elephants are getting whacked. You know, we have no control over stopping these poachers. We've got to bring it back and do it in a sustainable way. And he did. And you're going to see elephant populations flourish in Botswana and stabilize. The poaching will stabilize. So really, without hunting and that economic incentive to hunt, these animals just aren't going to endure. And that's what I see all over the place. I mean, where you've got nations that have well-regulated, well-controlled, well-managed hunting, you've got flourishing populations. And where you don't have that, where you've got so-called protections, where they've caved to the animal rights organizations, largely in Europe, they're in free fall. They're being snared, they're being poached for ivory and rhino, et cetera. So it's, you know, I would think after a while, if we tell this story enough, if we show the evidence enough, the world will figure this out. If you really give a damn about these animals, you would allow hunting. You wouldn't ban it. And that's really the bottom line.
Well, it just blows me away, because you say that, you say, like, if we keep telling this story, and I'll admit, we as a hunting community have not been telling the story as well as we should, or in the right way. The anti-hunting community knows exactly how to spin a story. They use that emotion. We tend to just fall back on, like, well, here's the cold, hard facts. How can you disagree with this? And then they come in with feelings, but I have feelings. And so we need to find that happy medium. But it is so aggravating that sometimes it doesn't matter what you show someone. And I just got into this with someone recently that I used to consider a friend on social, who recently was posting about an elk hunter that died. He made a bad shot, went and tracked the elk, and went to finish off the elk, and the elk gored him to death. And this just happened this year. Mm-hmm. And a former friend of mine, as I'm driving down to my elk hunt this year, posted, he's along the lines of how happy he was that this elk hunter died and how he deserved it, and all hunters should meet the same fate, kind of a thing. And I laid out the facts and I told him the story, and I'm like, hey, this is, and I refuted everything he said. And his whole argument was, you're stupid. You're an evil person. These facts don't mean anything because I have feelings. And I just don't get it. I mean, I'm an emotional dude. I'll get worked up about some stuff, but when the facts are in front of me, I'll at least consider them. And I don't know how you can even begin to reach people like that.
Well, I think you're touching on something that's really at the heart of the game, and it is a keen issue. It is a big issue. You know, it's one sort of facing all of us as hunters and anglers and trappers, et cetera. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, if somebody is so closed-minded that they won't even consider facts, you know, they're in a bit of a different category. And certainly I've encountered people like that as well. And I've gotten my share of, you know, let's say less than pleasant social postings and emails, and which I couldn't care less, makes no difference to me. But I think the greater pool of folks are the folks that just don't know. And they're not predisposed to not like hunting. I think they just don't know. They don't understand. They don't have those facts at their disposal, because I think, to your point, we as a community really haven't done a great job of telling our story. And we've had a lot of discussions about this very issue as well when it comes to what could we do as an industry? What could we do as an outdoor community to do a better job? And how do we mainstream our story, right? And how do we, we're really good at telling each other how great we are. And we know we're good guys and gals and have done wonderful things for conservation. But most people don't know that. They don't understand that. So how do we tell them that? And so I've spent a lot of my personal time trying to work on the mainstream side of how do we showcase hunters in a positive light and not hit people over the head with, we're great guys, love us, but more subtly, you know, through the nuance of the lifestyle, of the give back, and of the authenticity of the lifestyle. And we do it, you know, we did a series called Kodiak for a Discovery Channel, which was about the bear hunters on Kodiak Island. And one of the, I remember crafting one of the lines in the pitch to get the network to pick it up. And I said, Kodiak Island has the highest density of bears in the world, you know, not in spite of hunting, but because of hunting. And it's that management of those bears that has created an amazing flourishing population. And then how do we emphasize that in the series itself? We did Building Alaska. I think we've done it for 12 years, a popular series on Discovery and DIY. And in that, many of these people are hunter-gatherers that are building their dream cabin in the middle of nowhere in Alaska. And so you're showcasing that subsistence lifestyle. But I gave a talk in a big group in Nashville, about 1,000 people there in the sort of outdoor community. And I just said, look, where are our Super Bowl ads? You know, where are we celebrating all that we have done? And in Colorado, where I live, they've got a great ad campaign, which is financed by the state. It's financed through sportsman's dollars, but it's called the Hug a Hunter campaign. And it's a very simplistic, but it runs on all the TV stations. It runs on the radio stations in Colorado. They brought in a great agency, and I talked to the agency, and they said, look, we don't hunt. We don't have any background in hunting, but we think it's a great story. And we think we were better to tell that story than just maybe a traditional hunting agency or group, because we came from it at a perspective that was the general population. And so it's a very simple deal, and it's showcasing. If you like the national parks, if you like the, you know, the state parks, if you like federal ground, you know, if you like these national wildlife refuges, Hug a Hunter, because they significantly paid for them. And so the reason these species are thriving is because of hunters. Again, that's mainstream. I mean, that's to everybody in the state of Colorado who's watching television, who's listening to the radio, they're getting that. It's not just, you know, here's a very narrow market of folks that are already hunters, already anglers. And I do a column for Forbes, you know, and they give me a lot of latitude to write a lot of different things for Forbes. Forbes has 115 million views of their content every month worldwide. So it's a massive platform. And I'm able to talk about hunting and conservation destinations, characters in the outdoors, conservation organizations and what they've done, you know, and how they're largely supported by the CAMO coalition, if you will. And that's been fun. And again, I think what you're doing here, you know, this is all stuff that is going to reach people that aren't necessarily, maybe they're trapped in a vehicle with a hunter, but they're going to have to listen to it one way or another. So somebody say amen. But that's all good. I think we just have to be intelligent about the facts and how do we communicate that. And as I always tell my twins, you know, we have these debates all the time. Your argument is only as good as your facts. So don't lead with emotion. If you lead with emotion, you're no different than animal rights activists who are frankly just trying to raise money off the emotions of hunting and trapping and that kind of stuff. So anyway, that's something I think we as an industry have to be better at. There's ways to mainstream our story, to get it out there. You know, we're the full page ads in the Wall Street Journal celebrating hunting and conservation in America, the achievements, the species and how they flourished. The Shooting Sports Foundation, I think, has done a great job of creating all sorts of facts and a database, a wealth of information that if we take that out to the mainstream, it'll catch on. We just have to do it at scale. We have to be out there all the time. We need our own speakers bureau of people that know what the hell they're talking about, who can go on NBC News and Fox News and whatever and be talking about issues like Cecil the Lion. There will be another Cecil the Lion-like issue. And who do we have teed up to tell the story, to really speak for what the reality is on the ground? And so hopefully we'll be prepared. And those are the discussions I have all the time with industry leaders.
Well, you know, you're so right. And we so have a tendency to, you know, you see these RMEF, like they have these infograms that they put out and they're fantastic and they are really well put together. They tell the story clearly and concisely, and they're well produced. And the only place they ever run is on the RMEF YouTube channel, or, you know, in between some sort of hunting show or whatever it happens to be. And heck yeah, that's all good. But it's like we're just patting ourselves on the back. It's all self-congratulatory. You know, it's the pastor preaching to the choir. We don't need that. You know, we need to push, and yeah, it's going to cost more money. It's going to be harder to get in, but yeah, you're right. We need to push, and we need to have a commercial break on a mainstream TV show where we're not trying to sell anything. We're just spreading that message. And it's important to get that story out. Otherwise, yeah, it's just,
well, you're exactly right. And it's, you know, it's amazing to me now. And this is, I've been kicking these tires for 10 years at least. And it's amazing to me now how many people have come to the exact same conclusion you've come to, that we've got to be taking our message out to the mainstream. We've got to do it on a scale that matches the frequency of the animal rights or surpasses it. We have a better narrative. We have facts on our side, but we've got to challenge what they're doing. And there's a great website some of your listeners might know of already called humanewatch.org. But it's financed by a very wealthy guy. I think he's out of Baltimore. But you go there and it really exposes the animal rights organizations for the frauds that they are and what little they actually do for any wildlife or animals. You know, the Humane Society of the United States is in particular, they were convicted of federal racketeering charges, which most people don't know of. So next time your grandmother wants to give them some money to save the cats at the local pound, just understand they have nothing to do with saving animals at a shelter. But they've traded on that brand misidentity for a long time and haven't been called on it. HumaneWatch.org is calling them on it, and they're going bigger and bolder. But why can't we access Pittman Robertson funds to create a massive campaign, a sustained, this isn't a one-off and it's done, but why can't we create a really sustained national campaign to hit all the media platforms, to identify our celebrities, our spokespeople, to have our speakers bureau, to have our creative out there, to get into the schools and to really tell our story in a meaningful way. And one thing we're doing right now, just to speak to that level, is working with Ducks Unlimited, Delta Waterfowl, the Max McGraw Wildlife Foundation, really was the group that pulled this together to create an IMAX film. And the IMAX film is about the prairie pothole region, the prairie wetlands of Western Canada and North and South Dakota. Well, why are they important? Well, they produce about 70% of the water birds in North America. Ecologically far more important than the Everglades, the Bayou, et cetera. And yet nobody knows anything about this place. Well, who has been championing the saving of those wetlands? Well, it's been waterfowlers. It's been hunters. it goes back to the, you know, the genesis of Ducks Unlimited and Delta Waterfowl, shipping money into Canada to save those prairie wetlands and working legislatively to create, you know, conservation reserve programs, wetland reserve programs to help save those really vital habitat systems. So, you know, again, those are all things that we want to showcase in the film. We want, number one, people to know how important this area is, what a rich treasure it is, and you've never heard of it. Very few people have even ever heard of it. It's a very unique ecosystem left over by the glaciers, and it's now this amazing nursery of bird life in North America, and we've got to sustain it. We've got to protect it. We've got to grow it if we can in terms of bringing back some of the wetlands that have been lost. And so that's the idea of the film. But along the way, not necessarily in the film, but the earned media around that film is going to be talking about all that hunters have done for conservation and that waterfowlers have specifically spent, the National Wildlife Refuge System, the give back through Ducks Unlimited, Delta Waterfowl, private lands conservation that waterfowlers have put in to save these ecosystems. And that's, again, people wouldn't know. The average person, the average, you know, school group that goes in to watch the film in Chicago or in New Orleans or in New York or Baltimore, they wouldn't have any of that information. But we're gonna make sure they know, you know, who's been championing this and who's been really the voice of conservation in that area in particular for a long, long time. Of course, waterfowlers.
And that is such an interesting story. I like it because it's not as well known as some of, even in the hunting community, it's not as well known as so many of the others. But I feel like, yeah, there are so many of those stories that can be shared that are really fascinating, even from a non-hunting perspective, that non-hunters can look at this and be like, oh, that's wild. I didn't even know that area existed. Mm-hmm. And we have so many of those stories and, you know, projects like what you're putting together with this, or you're helping to put together with this IMAX film and they're going to be so critical because I feel like we're definitely moving towards a tipping point one way or the other. And, you know, there's always going to be a fight and there's always going to be, you know, a challenge, but it's just one of those gut feelings. It feels like we're coming to a very, you know, over the next 10 years or so, it's going to be very critical to our wildlife and to our ability to enjoy the outdoors and kind of our passions that we've grown to love and rely on.
Well, Sam, let me use you as a focus group of one. If what would you say to the industry saying maybe it's time we created or we hired a mega agency, a really powerful media agency that has every outlet on speed dial, has relationships with everybody, can be anywhere, anytime, and we developed creative that celebrated all facets of who we are, what we do, what we've given back, you know, the transformation of the American landscape by virtue of what sportsmen have done over 75 to 100 years. What would you say to that? And if we were to go to, you know, the federal government and say, we want to carve out the Pittman Robertson funds to take X percentage and to use that, not to shove it to every state for them to create their own storyline, but to really focus it on key messaging, proof test that messaging, know what resonates with the average population, create that material, and then take it out on scale and sustain it.
Well, and one thing you may not know about me is, because we didn't really talk about this, is I worked in the advertising agency world for about 12 to 15 years before I kicked off. That's what I was doing in LA. Okay. And so I have a couple of perspectives on that. One, you know, initially, like, yes, that would be absolutely fantastic. The key is finding the right agency, because let's just say the majority of that environment that I remember was not exactly going to be the most receptive to hunting. And we want to find someone that will not take the job and then be behind the scenes working against us. My other reaction is working with the federal government and using those Pittman Robertson funds. I think you can't get something from the federal government without them wanting to control it in one way or the other. And I think the worst thing that could happen to a campaign like this is to have the federal government have any oversight over it whatsoever. And, you know, this is me. This is then now my libertarian side coming out and saying, oh, the federal government, it's evil and they ruin everything. I mean, if you've ever been, let's just say if you've ever been to a federal website of any sort, God help us all. even the state websites are bad enough. And if there was a way where we could do it to where there, it was privately controlled, we were granted some of those funds one way or another with to use as, you know, earmarked specifically for this campaign, but it was at, say, the discretion of this creative agency to where it didn't turn into this, you know, just bland, you know, it's, I mean, this is just bland kind of federal government thing. If, you know, we were able to pick our lane, stay in that lane and just go full speed ahead, it would be incredible. I mean, it would be absolutely unstoppable, but there's a lot between us and there.
I think the cautionary tale of the federal government is well taken. The point is well made. I think that the opportunity here is this is a self-imposed tax. This is not a tax that the federal government, you know, we didn't have an obligation to do it. We did it ourselves. So to that point, that doesn't mean they wouldn't want oversight. I totally get it and agree with that. I think this is just a funding mechanism that we created, not the federal government. And whether it's a legislative move or however we need to carve that out, and get access to it, or if there's a different way, and maybe it's part of the Great American Outdoors Act that just passed, the funding mechanisms that are built into that. But it's got to be at enough scale. It's got to be at a size big enough that we can reach the scale that does make a difference. And I think that's what I'm getting at. And yes, totally agree. You sure as hell don't want the federal government running your messaging and putting a thumb on anything. It's simply, how do we get access to enough funds? We're not lightly taxed. We're already paying a lot of taxes. How do we get real value out of those taxes is the question. And I think if you were to put this to a vote to the average American sportsman right now, that is the people paying into these taxes, I think they would probably go, hell yes, it's time. Let's tell our story. Let's celebrate it. And because they're all living in a world where they see it every day. They see their kids getting pushed back at their schools, their friends, you know, wrinkling their noses at the idea of hunting, you know, animal rights messaging here and there. So we're all seeing it as less than 4% of the American population now. We're surrounded largely by people who don't do this. So it's time that we figure out the mechanism, whatever that is, to be able to do it, I think. I think the fact that you tweaked to it so quickly tells me there's an awful lot of people, and I've seen this now over 10 years of having these conversations with industry leaders. There's a lot of people going, we have got to address this. We've got to do it in a mainstream way. We got to get past telling ourselves how great we are and get that messaging out there. And it's been a huge driver for me for a long time.
Yeah, I think there's so much value in it, and it needs to, a way needs to be figured out. Something needs to be figured out to make this happen, you know, even if it's...
I think there's good leadership in the industry. I think, you know, Kyle Weaver, who's running the Elk Foundation now, I don't know Kyle, but I hear very good things about him. I think they're on track. You know, Laird Hamberlin, who's a savvy business guy, new guy running Safari Club International, knows what he's doing. You know, the new head of Ducks Unlimited, came in from Florida, congressman, hear fantastic things about him as well. So there's some good folks, but the question is, Jeff Crane at CSF, Congressional Sportsman Foundation, I think they're all sort of wondering who's going to take the mantle. Where is the leadership going to come from? And, you know, that's where we're sort of stuck right now. And that's where, you know, Johnny Morris, if you're listening, you may be our only hope here. The one guy this industry will listen to, you know, instantly is Johnny Morris, because he's done so much for conservation and is sitting in such an important seat that I think it might take somebody like Johnny to get this inertia moving. There's a willingness to want to do something, but there so far hasn't been the one leader to step up and say, let's do it. Here's the plan. Here's the team. Let's roll.
Well, I think that's what's going to be critical is having somebody finally step up. And even initially, you know, not necessarily saying like the person that takes this first step needs to be the face of it, the leader, but someone needs to take that first step and put together that concrete plan and say, this is exactly how we're going to do it. These are the people we're going to get involved and bring that. Like, you need to come. If we want to tap into those funds, we need to have that plan set, built out. We need to have the brand book. We need to know exactly what our brand voice and messaging is going to be. And that also then helps mitigate any issues we run into with people here and there, and this person and this congressman or this, you know, senator, whatever, wanting oversight over this. Because once we get them to agree to that brand book, we can say, listen, this is not in our voice. This is what we agreed to right here. Not that that's going to stop anyone completely, but I think that is what's key, is coming in, having that plan and somebody stepping up and putting that all together. And, you know, you've got, I was literally just before we were recording this podcast, I was discussing something similar for a new brand that we're currently creating for my job. And so my mind, you've got the gears flying in my mind right now with this.
Yeah. Well, look, and again, I think in the outdoor space, you know, it's going to take the big tent to do this, to be involved in this, but then it needs to be really savvy media marketing people and messaging creative types that take this out in a really compelling way. That's again, done on scale. And you get the bigger groups like Ducks Unlimited. Adam Putnam, by the way, is the name just came to me, is the new head of Ducks Unlimited, who's a very, very savvy political guy, having been a congressman for many years, new mover and shaker in the industry. I think he's in a position to step up with a big conservation organization the size of Ducks Unlimited and others. And there's plenty of others out there, but they all have to come together. And I think what I'm seeing right now in the industry, the good news is, they get it. They understand there's got to be something big and different and bold done. This isn't going to be a solution that sort of, you know, we each talk to our youth groups inside of our own little organizations and our own little silos. It's got to be done much broader as a community. And we have to do it soon because, frankly, I think we're on the clock.
I absolutely feel that. I mean, that gets back to kind of what I was saying earlier. I feel like these next handful of years are critical. It's, you know, we're at a big turning point, and I don't think hunting's ever going to completely go away, but it's not going to be, it already isn't like it was.
Yeah.
And I think I, you know, you're right. We're in a critical time right now, and some serious moves have to be made to protect what we love.
Well, let's get busy, brother.
Dang straight.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
So now that we've gotten a little bit heavy, you know, I'm just going to completely change the topic here. Very subtle switch. I'm good at that. I'm very kind of smooth.
That's life, right?
Yeah. You know, you are. We talked about this kind of at the beginning. You are one of the most traveled hunters around. You have been everywhere. You know, you sent over some kind of some video clips and things that I was checking out before the podcast. And I've watched them a couple of times because there's some good stuff in there. You know, I would love to hear just some of your favorite moments. Cause I mean, I've looked through when I'm watching those videos. I mean, we're talking a grizzly bear about to charge, you know, right before it goes down. I'm seeing hippos coming at you. And I, that always still sounds silly to me, but hippos are gnarly. There was the, you know, we were talking about elephants earlier. There's that one, just enormous bull with the broken tusk in the video, I remember. And oh man, there's some good stuff in there. I'd just love to hear some of the, you know, some of maybe your favorite stories or one or two.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you do it long enough and certain things happen, and I've sort of developed a fascination with dangerous game hunting. We created a series called Dangerous Game, which I think ran for 10 years under that title. And then we switched it to Deadliest Hunts when it changed networks. But it's a subset of hunting that is completely different, obviously, than every other form of hunting, because the stakes are so much higher. And some of the clips you're referencing were really put into a book that I just finished called Director's Cut, which Sporting Classics magazine published. And it's really a celebration of, I think, 21 different big game hunts around the world, with a companion film from each one of these locations as we were filming television shows on location. So it's an interesting, I don't think it's really ever been done, where somebody brought still photographers, really world-class still photographers in, and shot still photography, created book chapters, but then created a film chapter that is a companion to the same location. So it's really quite a package. But the bear hunt you're talking about was actually on Kodiak Island. And the funny story about that is the guy who I was hunting with, the guide, became the first season star of Building Alaska. Oh. And so that's how organically we find some of these shows. And I think we've done close to 200 episodes of Building Alaska. But, you know, this guy, he sounds like Tom Baudette when he talks, you know, and we were on that very same hunt. And he said, you know, Chris, I'm going to build a cabin right there. I said, well, Bob, there is a cabin right there. He's, yep, but it won't be for long. He takes his fishing trawler and he takes a giant cable and he hooks it around this, you know, two room cabin. And he just jerks that sucker all the way down to the beach and then burns it up. And of course, we're filming, right? So, you know, I'm, you know, taking notes on this, going, this shit's unbelievable. Wait till you see what, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to send it off to HGTV and DIY at the time. And I said, you know, hey, let me know when you get a chance to look at this, because you're going to, you know, you're going to want to call me right away. And they did. And they said, yeah, we'll take 10 episodes. Let's do it. Building Alaska. I see these guys are nuts. I mean, how they build up here, you know, they're using dog teams and they're using sleds and boats and helicopters and float planes to move their materials in. They're staring down bears and all that kind of stuff. And they're building in the most crazy remote locations. They're cutting their own timber. And anyway, so it became a really fun series. But that bear hunt, he said, you know, I like to call in my bears. I said, oh yeah, what do you call them? He pulls out this little like $5.99 Falk's Predator call, you know, sounds like a dying rabbit. And he gets up on a knoll and he starts squealing on this thing. And sure as hell, this giant 10'4" brown bear just comes rolling up the hill, and it pops up about 10 or 12 steps away, but it's striding and it's coming up on a hill, and I'm, you know, focused on a camera guy is behind me, and he strides. So when he strides, his head drops below. And when he comes up again, his head is inside of 10 steps. And I, you know, shoot him right in the middle of his chest with the 375 and multiple shots before this bear finally goes down. But it was one of those where it is classic understated way. He spins around and looks at me and he says, was that close enough for you? But it's, you know, just tons of memories like that are baked into the book and in the video. And I took Gerald McCraney, the actor, the Emmy winning actor, Major Dad, Simon and Simon. He just won the Emmy for This Is Us on NBC. And he's an old friend. And we went up there bear hunting. And sometimes it's not even the hunting. It's just getting to the hunt that becomes the story. And And we take off from little village of Kodiak, flying over to Poor Lions to hook up on this bear hunt. And the wind is howling. It's starting to snow. And we're in a three-seater, right? It's just a little Cessna, you know. And finally, the pilot comes in after waiting for hours and says, let's just give it a try. And I'm scratching my head going, what do you mean, just give it a try? I mean, once you're in the air, you're committed, right? Gravity never takes a damn day off. That's the problem. But anyway, we load up and take off and instantly hit this sheer wind, and the plane is just crabbing and then it's bouncing, and I'm in the back seat and McCraney's in the upper right seat pilot, and I've got one hand on the glass over here, one just so my head didn't smash into the window because it's shaking so violently. We're petrified. I mean, this is just one of those worst decisions of my life, was to get in this plane, and now there's like no turning back. You know, we're going to hit ground one way or another. And McCraney leans back, and classic McCraney, you do realize that if we crash today, the headlines are going to read Gerald McCraney and others died today. And over the din of the wind, it was F you. And anyway, we kissed the ground like the Pope and swore I'd never get in another plane again. But anyway, it was, lots of fun. Elephant hunting, you know, we've had elephants come at us at about the same distance. I had one come through a tree, not around a tree. I wasn't anticipating, you know, this 8-inch thick mapani bush going flat as the elephant came over the top of it to get to me, and shot him at about 10 steps as well. And so, yeah, there's all sorts of those encounters that you just sort of, you know, makes life interesting, I guess.
Oh, man. You got me grinning like an idiot here. Those are great. Those are absolutely great. So as we're kind of winding down here, one thing I always like to ask is, say you're talking with someone and they're like, you know, I've always been interested in hunting. Thought it was really cool, wanted to get into it, but I have no background in it. I don't know anyone that does it. It's pretty intimidating. I don't know if it's something I can do. What encouragement would you give that person?
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of resources out there now. And I think, you know, it's always nice to have a mentor, right? I mean, so much of this lifestyle really not requires necessarily, but it sure helps if you have somebody who's been further down the trail than you have and can kind of get you involved and you know, demystify everything from firearms to, you know, hunting regulations. I would love to see our state agencies simplify the regulations as much as they can. I think we've gotten a little carried away. I did an interview a few weeks ago talking about how game laws are a lot like taxes. Once you establish them, you can't get rid of them. You know, they just never go away. And did we really need all of these things? And the good folks in Colorado, and I think we have a great agency and good people, well-intentioned folks, but I would sure love to see about, you know, 20 or 30% of those regulations evaporate, simplify. And at the end of the day, that'll get more people involved because it won't scare the hell out of them. You know, how do I possibly do this legally? Because it looks to me like there's 112 ways to do it illegally. And is that really what we're trying to do here at the end of the day? But I think Ranella has done a nice job with Meat Eater. I think there's some good stuff there. The Shooting Sports Foundation is a great resource. I think join the conservation organizations. If you join a conservation organization, even if you're not a hunter, chances are you're going to be able to go to a banquet event. You're going to get to meet people who are hunters. And I don't know of anybody who isn't interested in helping somebody get started. You know, there's nothing better in my world than taking kids, taking adults, baptizing them into the lifestyle, because we know how much it means to us and how much it's meant to us. And if we can share that, we'll do it. So those are tips I would certainly suggest.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for hopping on. If folks wanted to follow along with the adventures, where can they find you?
You know, Sporting Classics, TV, Instagram, Facebook is a good place. Of course, the Dorsey Pictures, if you want to see what else we're up to in terms of other television and films and things like that, dorseypictures.com is a good one. But really great to be on, Sam. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you very much for taking the time.
Cheers.
All right, y'all, that'll do it for this episode of The Wild Initiative. Make sure to check out the show notes page at thewildinitiative.com. Get links to everything we talked about in today's episode. Big thank you to Chris for taking the time to hop on. Really enjoyed our conversation. Really looking forward to looking more into creating some sort of pro-hunting campaign on a large scale. I really think that's something that could be incredibly valuable. But y'all, that'll do it for this week. Looking forward to next time. But until then, I hope this podcast inspired you to get involved, get outdoors, and plan your initiative for the wild.
Thank you for listening to The Wild Initiative. Please take a moment to leave a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher. And head on over to thewildinitiative.com to get show notes, check out the blog, gear discounts, other podcasts from The Wild Initiative family, and more.